Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Bob and Yurt Live. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church. There's a potential war looming in Southeast Asia again for us. We've fought two major wars there, Korea, Vietnam. I have here in the studio, I have a book, A Soldier's Story, Forever Changed, An Infantryman Saga of Life and Death in Vietnam by Richard Hoag. What a book this is. Richard, thank you for your service and for writing this account that so honors the men who lost their lives in that fight for freedom.
And you're welcome. I was happy to share my story because most people, if they weren't there, had no idea what it was like to serve as an infantryman during the war.
Could we begin by talking about the end of the war and then its aftermath as a refresher? All these years later, there's so many who have forgotten, and then there are young folks who never learned. We ended up negotiating for a settlement, but really we had won every major battle.
Yes, we did. Militarily, our losses, even though they were 58,000, the enemy losses were over a million.
Yes,
and that is the truth. If you do the research on the major battles, we were victorious. And the thinking was that over time, they will give up.
But they didn't give up. There were extremely lopsided casualties in battle after battle, thankfully. But here at home, our college campuses had a soft spot for the communist North. They protested the war, and our leaders lost the will to win.
That's really what happened, is the people back home started hearing about the American losses, even though they were much less than the enemy losses, but they were still in the thousands.
Yeah.
And people didn't feel there was any real motive to winning the war or strategy to winning the war. Mm. We were just continuing to sacrifice troops without an end in sight, so to speak.
So we pulled out, and within a couple years, the South was overrun.
That's correct. We had worked with the South Vietnamese Army ourselves with the indication and the strategy that they would eventually take over the war. But they didn't seem to be well-motivated, well-trained, and frankly, and unfortunately, it isn't a surprise to me that the North just came and defeated the South Vietnamese Army relatively quickly.
Well, there was the fall of Saigon. And then you have what the communists refer to as a unified nation, and there's peace, but as was predicted by so many who supported the war effort, and I was a child, but I remember in a debate in fourth grade in elementary school, the parents came in one evening, and I was on the side that we had to fight to win the war because of the basics, because human beings deserve justice, and communism was immoral. That was the argument. But after there was peace in the nation, then people started to flee, and there was this mass exodus of fleeing the peace.
And part of that was people who lived in what was the former South Vietnam were still being persecuted by the communist regime as it came in. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, basically, they were put in what was called re-education camps, which was similar to a POW camp. And many of them died in captivity. So if you had any indication that you had supported the South when the North took over, you were in trouble.
Yeah, well, even in the North, the communists, when they took over, they had their land reforms. Sounds so nice, doesn't it? And they killed almost one out of every 150 villagers were executed. And then the boat people, so many died at sea. The estimates are up to 10% of the Vietnamese seeking freedom and justice. And they died at sea, and still it continued the outflow. Now I think it's 2 million people have fled the peace and the communist prosperity.
And that's true, and it's unfortunate that happened, but I think people just felt they were in so much jeopardy that they didn't have a choice, but maybe even risked their lives, and some of them died trying to escape that situation.
Yeah. You mentioned we lost 58,000 Americans and that more than a million North Vietnamese died in their battle to enslave the South into communism. But, Richard, you make those numbers personal not only by the account of those you fought alongside of who lost their lives, but also with the names of your college classmen who died in Vietnam and in your NCO class, the seven who died in action there. So,
well, you can't help but take it personal when you know many of those individuals who were killed, and particularly those that I served with, they became like brothers. And it was a tremendous loss when those individuals were killed, and it's still difficult to talk about today.
Sure. Vietnam was the last country that fell to communism, you point out in your book. I think we tend to forget that. So that even though once Saigon fell, it was obvious that this was a loss for America because now the communists controlled the North and the South. But it did stop what had become a phenomenon of country after country being taken over by communist regimes.
And it did, and a lot of people don't think about it that way. Mm. They just think, well, we lost the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But it did stop. We made a point in both Korea and Vietnam that the United States of America, was willing to stand up to try to defeat communism or stop the spread. In a way, it has.
Because of the sacrifice of all these men and your own sacrifice, which we should get to, when I see in our country, and in fact around the world, you know, socialism is like a kissing cousin to communism. And it's just devastating to me to see the country that stood against the left, leftism, liberalism, has really been succumbing in more subtle ways, as all of Europe has and increasingly around the world. The world is becoming socialist.
It is, and we can have that debate forever. You mentioned freedom, and a lot of people just take freedom for granted. Mm-hmm. And in many parts of the world, they still aren't free. Mm-hmm. And there's no guarantee that we are going to live in our free society forever, because there's people that don't like us.
Right, exactly. We're speaking with Richard Hoag, author of A Soldier's Story, Forever Changed, An Infantryman's Saga of Life and Death in Vietnam. What is a punji pit?
A punji pit. At least that's the way we call them. Mm. What it was, they dig a hole in the ground, a couple feet deep, and then they would take bamboo stakes or some type of a stick with a pointed end, punch it in the ground with the points sticking up. And then they would cover it with some type of debris so you couldn't always see it. But if you stepped on it, you would fall in that hole with those pointed stakes sticking you in the leg or wherever it happened to get you. And then they would sometimes cover the stakes with feces or whatever just to make it even worse.
You're not only stabbed, you have an infection, and the infection may kill you.
I mean, it's a very crude device, but it worked.
And it's also a symbol of the different ways of fighting a war. The communists were using these very crude weapons in America at the time, even though now it's four, five decades ago, and so we've come so far since then, but we were using state-of-the-art modern weaponry.
And it's amazing where we thought we were very sophisticated and using the most modern weaponry, fighting a group that didn't have that technology, but they were a formidable enemy.
They were willing to expend any number, and obviously it was over a million North Vietnamese who died, the Viet Cong. Mm. And to America, we have always cherished the lives of our soldiers more than many of our enemies have. That's evident.
That's correct, and I think that was the view of the North Vietnamese. If they had to lose a million people, then they would lose a million people, and they would continue to fight the war because they didn't value life the way we do here
the
in
way
America.
That we do. And really, the whole leftist worldview, where from a Judeo-Christian perspective, God has revealed that we have a right to life. You know, do not murder, do not steal, do not commit adultery. These enduring principles that are absolutes, to the leftist world in communism, it's more like a social Darwinism, and it's almost like survival of the fittest. And so those moral values, they just don't, they're not there.
And that's true. And again, I don't know if we realized it at the time, but as I've done research, that is the case in Vietnam and many countries. They just don't value life the way we do. And just an example, I talk about situations. We always heard about the kamikazes in World War II. They would fly the planes into an American ship knowing that's a suicide mission.
Yeah.
They would use what's called sappers. And that people would sneak into an American fire base or position, mm-hmm. trying to kill or injure a few of us, knowing that they were most certainly going to be killed.
Yeah.
They were willing to basically sacrifice their life.
The kamikazes of the Japanese, it's not as well known, but the Germans had their own. They had rockets that were piloted. They were basically piloted rockets where the pilot would be killed in the blast. Of course, we're fighting Islamic terrorists, and they're especially known for suicide bombers. So suicide is inherently destabilizing, and the cultures that embrace it as a form of honor become cultures that undermine the security of the world.
That's correct. And we, as American service members, were never asked to do anything like that, even though a lot of Americans, you know, they sacrificed their lives and maybe dropped themselves on a hand grenade,
schooling
hand grenade. But we were never asked to go in on a suicide
mission. To knowingly
mission.
Kill yourself. The soldier who jumps on a hand grenade to save his buddies, his goal is not to kill himself. If the hand grenade doesn't go off, he doesn't then shoot himself. So there's a big difference between suicide and intended suicide missions and suicide for glory and honor versus heroism and risking your life. Mm-hmm. Two completely different things.
That's correct, Bob.
Even, and I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church, even Jesus Christ, who knowingly went to the cross the night before, he prayed, "Father, if there's any other way, let this cup pass from me." In other words, I don't want to do this, but if I have to, I will. So the comparison in the value of life, you mentioned that you're about to be deployed, and you mentioned this instruction, and at the end they said, "Any questions?" Nobody had any questions. But if any of your buddies are wounded or killed, what do you do?
Well, the kind of the American military philosophy is you don't leave someone behind, mm-hmm. you know, unless you don't have a choice. We always did that. We never left anybody behind. In my experience, not that people didn't get left behind. There were still thousands of missing in action in Vietnam. But that's our philosophy. Something happens to somebody, we get them back so they will eventually get home.
Right.
And again, that wasn't the situation with the enemy soldiers.
Right.
If they were killed, we walked away, we left the bodies there, and sometimes they would just lie there and
decompose.
Decompose.
Yeah, right. Right, so a fundamental difference in the value of the individual human life. Maybe we could back up a moment. You talk about what life was like before the war and, you know, growing up in the Iowa cornfields, and you hunted with your friends. And I wondered, when you got on the battlefield and you had to fight for your life, was any of that hunting experience, did that come in? Did that help you?
I don't know that it necessarily helped when I got to Vietnam, other than I was familiar with using weapons.
Yeah, so in basic training,
but it was so
perhaps
different. You know, we were hunting pheasants and squirrels and rabbits, and nobody was shooting back at us.
Right.
And over there, we were hunting the enemy, so to speak.
In but, rice paddies.
Yeah, rice paddies, woods.
Yeah, the jungle.
Just jungle.
And they were shooting back.
Yes.
Right.
That's the big difference. And nothing can prepare you until it actually happens.
No, right. Of course. My wife and I, when we watch and we seek out films and documentaries about World War II, about the Vietnam War, and we're just so moved by the sacrifice. And we think of our struggles. And, what are our struggles? The van won't start, and so you got to bring it to the shop. Those are our struggles. And compared to what you went through, Richard Hogue, you mentioned volunteering for the draft. And I read that phrase, and it sounded sort of like a military oxymoron, volunteering for the draft. Could you talk a bit about that?
The way the draft operated back in the late 60s, unless you had some like a student deferment. I had a student deferment when I was going to college.
You were eligible
to be drafted. And they would send you a notice and say you're drafted. You had to fulfill a two-year tour rather than 3 or 4 years if you enlisted. And actually what I did with a buddy after we graduated from college, we knew we would lose our deferment and we were going to get drafted anyway. We just went down and said, put our name on the top of the list. We volunteered.
We volunteered for the draft.
It was going to happen anyway, so we said, let's get it over with.
It's sort of like a soldier saying, we were ordered to volunteer for this mission.
Yes.
So then at Fort Lewis, you remembered, boy, all these years later, Richard, a saying that was on the bulletin board for those who have fought for life.
Yes, for those who have fought for it, life has a meaning others will never know.
Wow.
And again, I read it, didn't necessarily understand truly the meaning. But I do today because I appreciate life. I appreciate everything that I have because I could have lost it almost 50 years ago.
So basic training and then advanced infantry training and NCO school. You have a rather dramatic training photo of you falling through the air. You must be at least 30 feet up. And when this photo captures you, and I thought, there's no parachute on him up there.
No, it was a confidence course. We had to climb up a telephone pole, walk across a bank, and then drop about 40 feet into the water just to see if we had the confidence to do it.
Yeah, wow. So you get out of training, Fort Lewis. You're an NCO, non-commissioned officer. You're assigned to a platoon. How many NCOs would be assigned to a platoon?
It would vary over time, normally two or three. There would be approximately 25 men in an infantry platoon. The number would vary as people would come and go. But there would be two or three NCOs, and then we would have a platoon leader who is normally a first or second lieutenant.
Okay. And this platoon, perhaps you could describe your platoon and tragically the changes in among the men you fight with because you're losing men. But could you tell us about your platoon?
When I got there, even though I'd gone through considerable training, it was still a lot of on-the-job training that I would still need. And I made some very good friends with some individuals who had been there longer than I had, and they helped me out. We ignored ranks, and I listened to them so I could kind of learn the ropes and strategy and tactics, because what we learned in training was totally different than what it was really in Vietnam. But the guys were great. None of us wanted to be there. We knew the hazards of the duty, that any day any one of us could be killed or wounded. But yet we got up every morning, we put on our gear, grabbed our weapons, and went out on a mission.
So it really was different than the Great War, World War II, when Japan attacks Pearl Harbor and the Germans are slaughtering people by the millions in Europe and people enlisted because they wanted to fight. We were attacked. And then you move forward to the Vietnam War, where really this was an ideological war, but I say that in a good way. Because we're trying to preserve freedom and justice in the world. And we're doing this on a battlefield that was half a world away in a very different culture with people that didn't look like us and spoke a different language. And so of the hundreds of thousands who were drafted, many would wonder, why are we here? Why are we fighting? You're saying your platoon had that same experience.
Yes, even though we went out and did our job, knowing it was extremely dangerous, I believe there was a lot of men there that really didn't know why they were there. It wasn't something that they spent a lot of time talking about during their training. Mm-hmm. They simply trained us to go and fight and didn't necessarily explain why. And as you say, Bob, it was different than World War II. Yeah. We weren't there and say, by golly, we're going to win this war.
We're defending our homeland.
The motivation for most guys and females who were there is to get you through your 1 year. The normal tour was 1 year, and survive your tour and get home.
Mm-hmm. So the first action, you know, we use that clean word, action, that you saw with your platoon.
The first real action was in middle of September. We used to often go out in the evening and set up an ambush along a trail or where you might expect some enemy movement at night and just sit there at night waiting for someone to come by. And our platoon, we actually were working with some South Vietnamese troops. We're going out to set up an ambush, and we got ambushed. Mm. You know, we were way behind schedule. It was dark. We walked through these group of hooches, and the enemy opened up on us. One man was killed. A couple guys were wounded. And we pulled back and carried the guys and the one guy that was killed back into our fire base. And that was really the first real action where the bullets were flying over my head. Fortunately, they were over my head. In September, it was very unfortunate because one man was killed initially during that firefight.
Throughout your book, you include these historical notes, and I so appreciate that part of your writing, Richard. I'm speaking with Richard Hogue, author of A Soldier's Story Forever Changed. Richard, in parts of your book, it's like you're speaking right to your buddies. You bring it home.
And I did that intentionally just to bring in the personal aspect and the personal view because I was very personal.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of interaction that we had with the individuals and at a lot of these conversations I remember. And I think it's important for people to understand the emotions that were involved in the day-to-day activities and the interaction between us and what happened. And in the most situations, it was positive. Sure, we had a few disagreements. Mm. But amazingly, the stress that we were under, majority of the time and the majority of the guys, we got along well. We were friends. I can recall one conversation that I had. It was a late afternoon conversation. We had just returned from a mission, and unfortunately, we had lost one of our guys. We were asked to walk back to our fire base about 10 miles, and our point man had obviously unintentionally tripped a wire on a booby-trapped hand grenade. And the second man to come through was hit with shrapnel, and unfortunately, he died. And we didn't put him on a chopper. We didn't know if he was dead or alive, if he survived. And then we finally got the word. My company commander came over and said Red died. That was his nickname, Red. And the individual who was walking point walked away because he knew that he had tripped that booby trap unintentionally.
Oh.
You know, you just couldn't see those trip wires. And so after a minute or two, I went over and talked with him. His name was Vic. And he was very distraught. He basically said, I killed Red. I says, no, you didn't.
No, of course not.
The enemy did. Yeah. They set the booby trap.
Yeah.
And we all know how impossible it was to see those booby traps, see trip wires. And we had a conversation, and he still felt terrible. Hmm. But basically that's the word I said. You didn't kill Red. Hmm. And I told him to take some time, spend some time by yourself. I said, I'm going to take you off point. You can't be walking point anymore after this happening. And it was a very serious and sad conversation. Mm-hmm. But sometimes those conversations had to be had depending on what happened.
Yeah, do you remember when that was, what month that was?
That was just before Thanksgiving, 1969.
Okay.
Late November.
Earlier in the year, I think it was in the spring, there was the Battle of Hamburger Hill. That was one of those where the casualties were so thankfully out of proportion. We lost maybe 70 guys, and the Viet Cong lost about 700. And we take over this piece of real estate that the military brass says really has no tactical advantage, and we just give it up. That was pretty common, really, that we'd win. There was the battle for Khe San, right near the what became the DMZ, and what a loss of life there. The North Vietnamese Army, do you remember how many they lost in that war, battle?
It was thousands.
Yeah, I think it was tens of thousands. And we only kept that that piece of real estate for a couple months. And this war, we hoped it'd be one of attrition for the North Vietnamese. They had what seemed like a plentiful supply of people who would die. And so as that year went on, what a bloody year. We get to the end of the year, and it becomes just horrific for your platoon.
It was. In December 1969, on December 17th, I could remember the date exactly, we were in an area called the Hobo Woods, heavily infiltrated by the enemy. We rarely went out there with something bad happening. We were going through an area, we was told, heavily infested with booby traps and landmines. We'd probably been walking for 10 minutes. Another one of our point men had tripped a landmine. Landmines are designed to destroy vehicles, so you can imagine what it would do to the human body. I walked forward. It was a huge explosion. I walked forward. It was deadly science. I found this individual, our point man, sitting in his huge crater. I thought he was dead. I walked up to him, put my hand on his shoulder, and he looked over at me. And I looked down at his legs. Both of his legs were completely gone at his knees. I mean, gone. There was no sign of either one of his legs. The landmine had just blown them off. Amazingly, he survived that experience. Unfortunately, he died of pneumonia on Christmas Eve, 1969.
Oh, my.
And I was fortunate. One other individual was killed instantly. Another individual was seriously wounded by shrapnel, and I received a small shrapnel wound from that landmine on the side of my head. So I was very, very fortunate, considering the magnitude of that device.
How many guys, as personnel, move in and out of your platoon because of injuries and because of deaths? How many guys were lost in your platoon?
I was there for just a little over 6 months, July 69 to January 70. During that time, 12 members of my platoon were killed in action.
Oh, my. 12 members. And you left early. There's a chapter in your book, Doc Saved My Leg. And so that's why your tour was cut short.
Yes. In January 27th, 1970, I was in charge of an ambush patrol, and another one of the guys hit a booby trap. It was pretty close to me. I received a shrapnel wound in my right hand, my right foot, and the most serious injury was to my left leg, and it was later amputated in surgery below my knee.
So, Richard, over the last 20 years, on and off, I would have the privilege of being with your family. You live here in the Denver area. And you would always, it seemed to me, be very pensive and very thoughtful. And we didn't really know each other. I knew your wife Marilyn so very well, and some of the kids and the in-laws. But I didn't know you well, and I didn't know what you had gone through. And when now thinking about that and the time you've taken to write down your story, you must have been reliving the battles as you wrote.
Oh, I certainly did. As I mentioned in the book, you know, I'd sit at my computer with tears in my eyes sometimes. And I reached out to friends that I still know that I served with to get some of the facts and recall some of the names. But it isn't something that's easy to write about. It was the most demanding physical and emotional experience of my life. But as I said earlier, I think it's important to share the story that I have so other people understand the sacrifices that all of us made for our country.
And you have some great endorsements for the book, including right here in the Denver area from KOA Radio competing stations. Stephen Tubbs, who's the director of the Cross Generational Battle with PTSD, and he's a radio host. So, hey, I want to thank you so much, Richard Hogue, for the honor of you coming into the studio and being here with us.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
And the book, A Soldier's Story Forever Changed, we will link to it so you can get it easily. Just go to our website, kgov.com. May God bless you.